Welcome to the Investing in Real Estate podcast with Clayton Morris. This is the show where we focus on buy and hold real estate. Why do we do it? We do it for the purposes of creating passive income and legacy wealth for you and your family. If you're interested in finding your freedom number, come over to our website at morrisinvest.com/freedom and download your free financial freedom cheat sheet today. Hey, everybody, welcome into another episode of Investing in Real Estate. This is the show where we talk all about buying real estate for the purposes of creating cash flow. We're not selling our properties, we're holding them long term. That's the goal, so that we can create legacy wealth, hand that wealth down to our family eventually. And we want to build financial freedom. And I'm thrilled because we have an interesting sort of case study episode today. One of the guests on the show reached out to me a few weeks ago and said, "Hey, I've been listening to the podcast for a long time. And we took action, started investing. We've got four properties with our LLC. We've done some seller financing, private money, and we're now shopping for our fifth property. And we'd love to talk about it." And I said, "You know what? That sounds like a perfect case study episode. Let's do it. Let's have you on the show so you can tell your story." That was Thomas Hatley who reached out to me, but he's got a business partner, Jason Mott. They both have teamed up. They're young guys. And they're just taking action doing real estate deals. And that's been so exciting. So guys, Jason, Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Clayton.
Yeah, it's been a great treat having you here on the show. So how did you first learn about what we do?
Well, Jason and I were kind of taught, we were college roommates, and we've always kind of been talking about how do we, you know, establish financial independence. It's always been kind of a dream that you know, him and I both share and kind of bounce each other ideas off of each other about. And I was actually out of the country for work, and we had just been communicating about ways to approach that. And I can't remember. I think Jason came to me and said, "Hey, you should check out this podcast that I found on iTunes, Clayton Morris Investing in Real Estate." And we both kind of started listening to the episodes, and you know, I'd get excited about something and text him and say, "Man, did you hear what Clayton said on the show today? Like, that's so awesome. We got to do that." You know,
great.
We both have entrepreneurial spirits. So when we stumbled across this podcast and it gave us an avenue to put that energy into, I think it has just absolutely been go, go, go ever since.
That's great. That's great. And so you guys didn't really come from a real estate background, right? But you had that entrepreneurial spirit. What was it about real estate that finally clicked for you guys?
I think for us, it was, we were looking at a way to create meaningful cash flow now, not when we're 85, not when we're 75, not when we're getting our distributions from our IRA, et cetera, et cetera. We wanted a way to create meaningful wealth and meaningful cash flow now. And I can tell you, I mean, I don't think that there's a better way to do it passively. I mean, obviously, if you start a business and sell a product, you can create crazy cash flow, but to do it and it not consume your life, I don't see a better avenue than real estate.
And you guys took an interesting approach too. The smartest approach you can take, which is, you know, it's the rich dad, poor dad model, right? He says there are four, you know, there are four asset classes that enable you to make money, right? Owning a business, buying real estate. And he said the key is starting a business and owning real estate. That's like the double-edged sword. So when you guys got started, you said you guys knew you were going to be starting a business. You weren't going to be buying these properties in your own names, right?
Yes, it's always been an LLC. We've never even considered doing it in our own name. Hmm.
And what were some of the downfalls, pitfalls that you saw if you didn't buy it in your, you know, in an LLC?
Well, I mean, I mean, part of it was a big part of that was personal risk. You know, we're both homeowners ourselves, so we didn't want anybody to be able to come after our own personal assets. And then you were going to add something.
Yeah, we kind of stumbled into it backwards too, because I developed a relationship with a mortgage broker, and the mortgage broker told me, "Well, you know, we can do investment loans." And so myself and Thomas said, "Well, that's great. That's wonderful." So we set up the LLC, you know, well, this was after we had purchased our first property, and we went back to him and we did all the paperwork, and he's like, "Oh, I can't loan to an LLC." So that was definitely a pitfall that we had, and that kind of spurred our private money pursuit.
So let's just back up a little bit here. You know, I want to hear about your careers a little bit and how that enabled you to kind of take action with these first few properties, because not everyone's in your situation, not everyone's in your boat, but it sounds like you kind of were in the corporate America space as well, right?
Yeah, we both are.
I worked, I don't anymore. Oddly enough, I work as a mortgage analyst now, but when we started the business, I worked in logistics for Target, and
And I work for a capital construction company.
So you were around the construction space and you saw all this coming together. What, you know, when you come from that background, it's very easy to sort of fall into the trap of thinking about the 401k plan. And every year I'm working on getting a raise. Did you guys, were you guys part of that philosophy, or were you, did you break away from that early on?
I think we both fortunately broke away from that, like right out the gate. We both had some experiences with work and work-life balance where it was kind of like, okay, we need to find something, something that's going to provide, you know, a better space for that. And also, you know, just seeing some of the hearing stories about the downturn and what that did to people who had large lump sums of money in their 401k that just disappeared overnight and things like that.
Right.
We went into corporate America knowing the risks with putting all your eggs in that basket.
Right. And I think too, Thomas and I both still contribute to our 401ks, IRAs, so on and so forth. But to put all of that, all of your emphasis on that, I think is dangerous. And then it's also a live later mentality. I mean, it's basically build up a big enough savings account that you can take money out when you're older. And we just think that is just the craziest philosophy that we've been sold. So we kind of broke free from that real early.
What is your philosophy? I mean, you know, you read Tim Ferriss, The 4-Hour Workweek. He makes the argument that why would you want to wait until you're in your 70s to start enjoying life? I mean, everyone wants to save for retirement so that when they're 70, they go to the beaches and they relax. But now they can't even walk.
Right.
You can't get up and down the stairs anymore because your hip needs to be replaced. Like, what if you could live that life now? How old are you guys? You're 28, both of you?
Yes. Yeah.
So what is your philosophy now on that?
I mean, that's exactly in line with our philosophy. In fact, I've read the 4-Hour Workweek. I read it about a year ago. And, you know, I totally agree with that statement. I mean, what we both, I think, want to live now and not wait till we're older to have that financial independence. I mean, for me personally, this is about financial independence.
I agree. This, me too.
Right. Yeah, that's the key, is making sure that you're creating that financial independence now in your youth. Now, this LLC, you partnered together on this LLC?
Yes, it's called the Hatley and Mott LLC. It's very creatively named.
That's great. It's like the Hatfield and McCoys. Yeah,
right. That's right.
So that brings up an interesting question. You guys are friends, right? You own properties together. Have you guys discussed what would happen if maybe, you know, hey, Thomas decides, you know, I'm done with real estate investing?
We haven't had an in-depth discussion about that. No, it's something that we know we do have to discuss, and it's on the table for us. But
it's in our corporate operating agreement is how, I mean, we did have to kind of write out what would happen, how it would unwind, you know, so it's written in there and signed, but it's not necessarily something we've sat down and discussed because we're taking the long view on this. And I think we both agreed when we started it that we're taking the long view. We didn't just hop into it randomly. So we both feel pretty strongly about, you know, the route we're going.
Right. And we both also, you know, we've talked about like, when we both have family and children, you know, I want to be able to hand a portion of these properties off to my children. Jason would like to be able to hand, you know, it's that legacy wealth that we're trying to create.
Yeah. Right. It's the same thing. It's like how, you know, Warren Buffett buys a stock and he says his favorite investment is forever. And that's how Thomas and I make our decisions on these houses, is how we decide how we're going to repair them, how we're going to renovate them, how we're going to act on them, is we want to keep it forever.
That's great. So I want to kind of dive into some specifics on some of your structures of your deals and what you did. So the first property you grabbed, tell me about the numbers and how you bought that property. What caused you to take action? Because so many people get bogged down in sort of analysis paralysis where they hang around in internet forums, you know, those people, and they never take action. I think misery loves company. So, yeah. You know, I avoid those internet forums at all costs because, you know, it's a bunch of people talking to other people who never take action. And right. So it's very easy to get sucked into that world. How did you guys avoid that?
Well, Thomas and I are a wonderful duo in this, whereas I am the deals guy. We would own probably 100,000 properties with five of them working if it was up to me, and Thomas is much more of the, is it going to work? And what happened was we started it, and I just, you know, I wish I could tell your listeners, and I wish I had an easy answer to this. I wish there was some magic formula or some website But I mean, I just poured through internet ads, basically. I just absolutely poured through Craigslist, Zillow, Realtor.com, the paper. I mean, just everything, looking for homes. And we probably sent, I don't even know how many emails I sent looking for our first deal. And then finally, you know, we found this duplex and it just clicked. You know, the owner was willing. We presented him with the deal. We were able to make a deal. You know, I believe we bought it for $33,500. It brings in $865 a month. And then in order to get our cash flow where we need to be, we put in a $4,000 balloon payment. So we only seller financed. I can't do the math off the top of my head, but we only amortized
for 4 years.
Yeah. So it got our cash flow where we needed to be.
So part of the blessing of our situation, I mean, neither one of us had a whole lot of capital, right? Because we're relatively young.
Right.
So we were basically stuck in a corner to where we had to create, we had to make a creative deal with a seller. So that's what drove us to seek out a seller finance deal. And then,
yeah, the beauty of the seller finance, and we've done an episode specifically on that because, you know, not everyone has cash. I mean, most of our buyers, you know, Morris Invest are, you know, doctors, lawyers, players in the NFL, major, you know, they've got $100,000. They want to buy two properties. For them, that's a no-brainer. If someone's got a 401k, they can roll that in. Great. They've got a 1031 exchange. They want to buy 10 properties, and we work with them all day long. Where it gets tricky is when someone doesn't have cash, right? So how do you make that work? Well, seller financing, it takes a lot of work, as you just talked about. Like, you wrote to hundreds of people to try to find a deal. You put it together. It took you a long time, and you found a deal. And, you know, I think that goes a long way for making this happen. That's when you're starting out in real estate investing. You don't have the capital, but you want to take action, getting on the phone, making deals happen. You were out meeting with different sellers. Were you out different a bunch of different properties as well?
Yes, we've seen a lot of properties.
Right. And, you know, it's key too, because I think what's great about this is that you don't know everything, right? Do you know everything there is to know about real estate investing at this stage?
No. And I will tell you this, the first offer we made on a house, the seller asked us to send over a contract. And this is going to sound absolutely crazy, but I didn't know what a real estate contract was. So I literally typed up a Microsoft Word document and sent it over to them. And we have learned so much since then.
But that's the key. And I hope my audience is paying attention. I love this because you remind me a lot of, you know, a younger version of me, which is, you know, if I get it, like I'm 70% there, I'm 80%, I just do it, you know? And that's how you learn, by taking action. You're never going to be 100% on anything in your life. And I love that you just, I don't even know what a real estate contract is. And that's the thing too, when you're going through and learning wholesaling or any form of real estate investing, so many people want to put the cart before the horse. So instead of just getting on the phone and taking action, they're more worried about the contract. Well, I don't have a contract. Well, yeah, but you haven't even gotten on the phone yet. So what do you care about a contract? You know, just get on the phone first, get a deal, and then worry about the paperwork later.
Yeah. Had we waited till we were 100% sure on any of our real estate deals, we'd be sitting at zero houses right now.
Right.
That's great. So anyway, you get this contract drawn up. It's a seller finance deal. How did you – did I imagine – and a lot of times when you're starting out in real estate investing, it's the seller that is aware of seller financing. It's that landlord. It was that tired landlord that was aware of seller financing because he doesn't want to get hit with capital gains, and therefore he can finance it over a number of years, and that – you know, it softens the blow for him because the goal is you never want to have to sell properties. And so – as a landlord doing seller financing, as Tom Wheelwright has talked about here on the podcast, it's a really attractive option because it defers that tax burden that he's going to get hit with if he sells it all at once. Did he inform you about seller financing, or is that something you were actively seeking?
That's actually something we went to the seller with, and I believe we had heard it from your show, Clayton.
Oh, great. Yeah,
we had sent enough contracts in, and this is just our personal philosophy, that when we find a deal we like, that instead of going, because a lot of times if you ask a seller, hey, are you willing to do owner financing or seller financing? Most of the time you just get a flat no. And so what we started doing is we write the contract with the deal that works. Yeah, we always make reasonable deals. You know, we put in reasonable offers, but we write the contract with a deal that works for us. We sign it and we send that thing over because we believe it's a very powerful thing to hold that piece of paper in your hand, see signatures and say, if I sign this, this house is gone, all my troubles are gone, you know, whatever it is. So instead of with this first deal we did, we took it to them and we walked through it. But with some subsequent offers we've made, we have just written the contract that works for us, and we send it to them. I mean, ready to roll, ink on paper.
That's great. Well, that's the power. I mean, in my success with doing wholesaling, you know, the difference from my success and others, for what I found was because I was willing to make offers. When you're willing to just make an offer, put a contract in the mail to a landlord that may or may not be, he's kind of on the fence, you don't know about it, but you feel like it's a deal. He doesn't have probably another contract from somebody else, but he's going to hold on to that piece of paper, and now it's real. And he can sit there and he can think about it over dinner. He can come back to you the next day and say, is this deal still good? You know, if your offer's still good, I'm ready to pounce. I've had guys come back to me 4 months later. Some of my biggest deals that I've ever done have come back, you know, months and months later. And it's because I had mailed them a contract with my business card on it, that they had that, they held on to it. That's going to sit on their desk and they're going to take action on it.
Yeah. It's hard to deny it when you're looking at it every day.
Right. So let's talk now that first property seller finance. That's great. Are you managing the property yourself? And what are the tenants? How did you handle that situation? Finding tenants, screening them, going through that process?
So we actually inherited tenants both in the front and back unit of that duplex, and they're still there. They had both been there, I think, for 5 years plus. So the tenant situation was great, which is one of the reasons why we went after this deal aggressively. We hired a property manager. It was the first property manager, obviously, that we hired, and things have worked out great for us so far.
That's great. I mean, I'm glad that you guys, even though these properties are in your backyard, you didn't fall victim to trying to manage them yourselves.
No. And, you know, yeah. And the reality is we couldn't, you know, we don't have the bandwidth to manage them ourselves. And Thomas and I both have started this with the idea of passive. We want to set up our infrastructure. We want to have people in place so that, you know, one day this can be truly, truly passive, and managing them ourselves just was never an option.
That's great. So the tenants, inherited tenants. Now, this is a bit of a cautionary tale because I have a lot of people send me properties. Hey, are you interested in buying this property? You know, and very often if there's tenants living in the property, I don't know how they were screened. I don't know much about their history. I don't know if they pay on time or if when I, you know, so very often if there's tenants already in the property, that's not a sales pitch to me unless I've done it myself with my team, and my property management team has vetted the tenants, placed them. So you guys took even more of a risk, which I love. You're like, okay, I don't know. We're just going to do it. Let's just get it done. Now, sometimes, you know, you might have gotten some great tenants, but a lot of times those can be troubled tenants. You don't know, again, their history. Do they pay on time? You know, what was the screening process done? And you know, and let's be honest, older landlords can like fudge tenant ledgers and that kind of stuff. We've heard certainly stories here on the show about commercial properties where, you know, 100-unit building, they found out later they had to take them to court because half of the people were fake tenants. They weren't even living there. They were fake ledgers, you know. So how did you handle that part of it? Did you have any nerves about it, or were you just happy not knowing what you didn't know?
I would say it's a little bit of both. I mean, we certainly did have some nerves about it, but you know, we figured the upside of that is we have that cash flow coming in right off the bat. Jason had actually been to the property and met both the tenants, so you know, there was, you know, a little bit. We knew they were actually there,
right,
and living in the units.
Right.
I would suggest we did ask, and like you said, you never really know. We did ask for financials of like a rent roll, basically, you know, to show where the tenants had, they had collected rent and things like that. But yes, absolutely. This entire endeavor was an absolute calculated risk.
That's great. I mean, now there are certain things that you've put in place, safety measures you've put in place, I'm sure mentally, just from your experience moving on to that second property. How did that second property differ from the first one?
Well, interestingly enough, the second one, we didn't know this when we bought this property, but it is part of a portfolio of properties that an individual has left to his family. And so we basically, once we found that out, Thomas can talk about how he secured some private money for us, but we basically went back to them with cash and offered them a price to sell us two more. And then the third house was a completely separate deal, and it's actually in a different city. But that's how we went about those next three.
Now, talk a little bit about the private money. That's something that, Thomas, you had mentioned. You guys went that route. How does the private money come into this? How did you put that together? What gave you the idea to do that? And how, you know, what are the terms? Take us through some of that.
Yeah, sure. So the private money, again, was really out of necessity for us. I mean, we had conversations with banks and realized that they were never going to loan us money for real estate, for investment real estate.
Garbage.
So, you know, I picked up Susan Lasseter-Lyon's book. I told Jason he needed to read it too. We both read it. You know, we started throwing ideas together. And, you know, about that time, actually, it was funny enough, I was at a holiday dinner with family and friends and just kind of voicing my frustrations with trying to find private money. We'd been to CREA meetings. We had put ads on Craigslist. We'd had several conversations with people that kind of dead ended. And believe it or not, somebody at the table actually had some money that they were previously interested in putting into real estate before they even knew I was involved in real estate, and actually approached me about 2 weeks later and said, "Hey, Thomas, you know, I'm interested in working with you guys on making a deal." And it literally came out of left field for us.
Well, it didn't, you know, you think it did, but it didn't, because once you guys start aligning yourself with that kind of, I know I don't want to get all new agey on you, but when, but once you start, you know, aligning yourself with that sort of mental energy that you're putting it out there, you're talking. Susan talks about that, right, in her book. And by the way, episode 34 of this podcast with Susan Lasseter-Lyons, you know, she's considered the $800 million woman for the amount of deals she's done with private money. She's a rock star. So go back and check out episode 34 if you're interested in hearing more about that. But you put that energy out there, and she says, just talking to friends, like talking to people, letting them know, instead of keeping it to yourself and keeping quiet, no one's going to know that you're interested in real estate and that you're looking for money. And just even a dinner party recently, I had friends that know what we do in real estate investing, of course, and they see that we do, you know, 30, 40, 50 properties in a month. And they're like, you know, we've been wanting to do real estate. How do we get involved? We don't maybe want to own real estate, but we'd like to lend. You know, we'd like to do that. And I said, great. Well, yeah, let's talk. You know, that's how it happens. Just conversations happening. So it really wasn't out of left field. I think you guys started putting that energy out there and it just started to happen.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree.
Agree more.
It becomes your world.
Right. It's like when you're starting to buy a new car, right? Now you suddenly see it on the road everywhere.
Right.
You know,
that's right. And Thomas and I were just so excited about it, you know, and we went from writing Microsoft Word document, you know, real estate contracts to, we feel like we've squeezed in, you know, 5 years into one year span of lessons we've learned. And so we're just excited about it. And I think that does, you're right. Absolutely right. It just, people feed off of it. They see it. And, you know,
one thing that can become a problem is shiny object syndrome. I think I suffer from it. A lot of entrepreneurs suffer from it, because now you've got something that works and you're on your fourth, going for your fifth property. And this is when it starts to seep in, that shiny object syndrome. Well, maybe we should start doing commercial deals. Maybe we should start buying mobile home parks. Maybe we should start buying billboards. Maybe we should start, you know, and you get away from what started you on this path of success in the first place. Have you guys started to feel any of that?
Okay. So funny you say that. We actually were just in conversations with an apartment building, not a huge one, 10 units or so, about trying to get in on it. And they sent us the financials, and I was able to kind of go over the financials and look through them, and it just didn't work. And to give you an idea, the asking price that they wanted versus the rent revenue they were currently collecting, their net profit margin was negative 41% when I actually calculated it.
Wow.
Yes. And so we went back to them with an offer that we believed was reasonable, which was obviously incredibly under what they were asking. And we did a really good job of staying the course and sticking to our principles of, you know, this is what we're looking for. These are the returns that we need. But yes, we have actually, got shiny object syndrome a little bit, but we didn't necessarily make a bad deal.
We were looking at a commercial property on Main Street in a small suburban town of Greenville, which we anticipate is going to see a lot of growth in the next 5 years. And we would have loved to get into it, just, you know, strictly out of the emotional reason to be on Main Street of this small town would be incredible when it blows up. But it was disastrous and the numbers didn't work. So we were able to, you know, what it all comes down to is the numbers. And if they don't work, you got to walk away from it.
Right. And I couldn't stress to your listeners enough, and what Thomas and I constantly preach to each other is you've got to submit the offer that works for you. You know, no matter what the asking price is, no matter what you've got to submit the offer and make it, it's got to work. The numbers have to work for you.
Right. I mean, you can't just make people feel good.
Right.
I just don't want to make an offer because, what works for me financially, I just want to make that tired landlord feel good with the offer. It's like, well, I'm sorry, the numbers are upside down here. It just doesn't make sense. You got to be prepared to just walk away if those numbers don't make sense for you.
Yeah. And we always ask, like when we submitted the what would have been an incredibly lowball offer on the apartment building, we always submit explanation, right? We don't just send it in and say, hey, you guys are crazy. I attached the sheet I did all my numbers on and said, look, you know, this is, guys are crazy, kind of, essentially. Right. But explanation goes a long way in helping someone not necessarily feel like, oh my goodness, what are they doing?
Right. Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, a lot of times people just don't even know their own financials. I mean, I'll talk to investors all the time that own a property that they grew up in or that they've had for a number of years. It was their starter home. They've moved out. They're using it as a rental. And I'll say to them simply, what's the ROI on that property? And they won't know. They won't even know the answer to that question. And then once I get out the calculator and I sit down, I go over it with them and I say, oh, you're breaking even. That's zero. You're not even, or you're negative two on that property. I would be immediately selling that property. You know, like you got the appreciation, you've held on to it, just sell it and get into stuff that can produce, you know, a high ROI for you. Well, that's great, guys. I'd love to hear where you got with a minute or so we have left. What is the plan for this next round of properties? Where do you guys go from here? 28 years old. Jeez Louise. I mean, it's making me jealous now.
Yeah, I mean, we plan to grow exponentially, so we'll be out looking for more private money. Eventually, if a bank will talk to us, we'll get some money from a bank. But we're all in.
That's great. That's great. Any parting words of wisdom for our audience? As we have a lot of listeners who are just thinking about taking the plunge into real estate investing. Maybe they're sitting on their hands. They're not sure. What would you say to those people?
You have to do it. It doesn't. I mean, you're talking. I literally sent in a real estate contract typed up on Microsoft Word. Like, there's no one dumber than that. Like, you just have to. And I wish we had a magic bullet, but there's no easy way. You just have to get going. And eventually you'll make that first deal and then you'll make that second deal. And it might take a while, but it's worth it.
Well, I love it, guys. I love that you guys took action. You guys are an inspiration. This is exactly what I love to hear on the podcast. So thanks so much for sharing your story with us. And good luck, man. I hope to next time I talk to you, you guys got 20 properties under your belt.
I hope so.
Yes. Thanks for having us.
You bet. Great. Thanks great having you, Thomas and Jason. And thanks to all of you for downloading and subscribing to the podcast as always. And we really appreciate if you take just a few seconds out of your day and just leave us a nice review. Preferably 5 stars. I mean, I'll take less stars, but 5 stars would be nice. On iTunes, just go in there, click on, leave a review, and just type up if this podcast has meant anything to you. That would mean the world to me as well. So thanks, everyone. We publish every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, as you know, and we will be back on Monday with another episode of Investing in Real Estate. Now go out there, just like Jason and Thomas did, take action, type up contracts on the back of toilet paper for all I care. And just make deals happen. We'll see you next time, everyone.